think that often, like, transformative things happen when we're lost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's increasingly hard to get lost.
Right.
And that's something that I think we're really missing culturally.
Yeah.
Is, okay, I wouldn't have cultivated that situation. I wouldn't have sought it. But something in it produced a friendship and produced a memory.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 187 with Stephen Eastwood, who you just heard. He is a London-based artist and filmmaker. He is in East London, to be specific, for those of you who know the area. And the film that he is about to put out later this year, both in art form and in film form, if you will, concentrates on witnessing death. So, a remarkable conversation, remarkable story, way of looking at the world that we get into, I think you will find. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see some of Steve's films that have already been released, as well as the trailer for the film Island, the film in question that I was just talking about, and images as well, including one from a rather harrowing anecdote that we talk about towards the end of the exchange. So I encourage you to listen to the whole thing, starting with we get into London and how it's changed over the years, not unlike talking about New York or what have you. And he compares the situation with Brexit, with the situation here vis-a-vis the election. And then we wind our way into him being an artist filmmaker and what that's all about before we get into this recent film that is coming out soon. So that's the arc of it, just to give you a heads up. And I encourage you to stick around on the back end for some thank yous, an anecdote about my studio, I think it's sharing, but not oversharing. An incident at the studio, I will call it for now. Stick around for all that. And before we jump into the conversation with Stephen Eastwood, I just wanted to give a quick plug for how often do I do plugs, right? This is the show that I am organizing, curating, and it's called Focus Group, and it is opening May 20th at Charlie James Gallery. So if you are in Los Angeles, please come. I think the opening goes from 6 to 9, but probably will go a little bit later. So if you can make it during, you know, the 7 to 9, 7 to 9:30 span, I'd love to see you there. All right? I'll tell you more about it as we get a little closer, but wanted to give you a heads up about that. More on the back end, like I said, so please give me about 5-6 minutes on the back end. I have a lot to tell you, including that anecdote I referred to, so let's get into that conversation with Stephen Eastwood. In the meantime, thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you on the back end. You're in London, yes?
I am. I'm in East London.
East London. Okay, so you're going to have to orient those of us outside of the UK just for a little context and whatnot. What sort of neighborhood has East London been relative to the rest of the city?
So East London, when I first started making art and making films coming out of college, East London was a bit of a no-go zone. It was a place of crime. It was a packing district. It's gone through similar changes to Brooklyn, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of spaces up for grabs for artists to show work, to have studios, and the usual regeneration process has taken place. In fact, we were sort of unceremoniously kicked out of our studio as 120 artists last year. We'd been there for, I think, 10, 15 years.
Wow. And
it was bought up by property developers, but of course the development never took place and now it's a squatted building.
Oh, man. Wow.
So we moved further out. I'm in a place called Hackney Wick, which is right, I can see out of my window, the Olympic Village, where the Olympics were in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And every week a new condo block goes up. But we have a little colony here of artist studios, and we we're hanging on.
I don't know how familiar you are speaking of Brooklyn, but would you say Hackney or East London generally is kind of like the Bushwick of London, or what's your analog?
Yeah, I think that you could say, you know, the Williamsburg, Bushwick area. I spend a lot of time there with artist friends sort of 10, 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
a place of diversity. And I think Hackney is very similar in that it just got colonized by artists and then it got colonized by money. But wow. Hackney is the place that if you're flying in to the UK, into London, and you're reading that in-flight magazine, you'll see go to Hackney and sample all of the hipster bars and the pop-up cinemas. And, you know, it's still a diverse and interesting place.
Do you see far too many tourists, though, would you say?
There's a lot of tourists and a lot of investment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
But artists are year by year leaving London for cheaper and more affordable places, on the coast. Actually, a lot of people are moving to the coast, but London is still, I think, a very vibrant city, and it's still working for me.
Mm-hmm. So you were, before you got kicked out of that place that's now a squatter's village a year ago, how long had you been there before that? 10 years?
I think I've been there 15 years. In fact, I was a professor at a SUNY university in Buffalo for 3 years, but I kept my studio on while I was living in the States. So my studio was an incredible continuity for me. I went through, you know, different house situations, but the studio was always there, and there were many collaborators working with moving image and installation art and sound art that, you know, a lot of great projects came out of that space.
Right.
And then it got disbanded. So,
right. So the reason I ask is I was trying to get a picture of when you moved in, was it, would you characterize it as pretty dodgy, even dangerous, or just really underdeveloped and, you know, a little grungy, or how would you put it?
I mean, the dodginess remained. So we would still have, you know, there was a crack den in the adjacent building, and you'd get people hanging around at night. But London has got cleaned up by and large. I mean, it was in an area that was known as Murder Mile when I first lived there,
uh-huh.
because there was a lot of East End gang crime. And there was certainly, it was an area that people felt nervous about being in sort of 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that it's a familiar narrative, isn't it, that artists take over those places and bring different use to those places. And they are a part of, I suppose, of cultural redevelopment. And then their use is no more, and the money comes in,
right?
So, but Hackney is still a place of very different communities. I mean, it's still very ethnically diverse,
mm-hmm.
and it's still a place where. But I mean, I think London is a much safer place than it was when I first started living and working here.
And that's overall a very good thing, would you say?
I don't know. It's a big philosophical question.
Right. Well, because if you...
I think I would take my chances with the more dodgy elements.
Yeah, right. Of
keeping something more vibrant and more visceral and more edgy. I think now a lot of what takes place here culturally is, I think, more of an approximation or an assimilation of what was interesting. I sound quite negative.
No, I was fishing a little bit for that, because when you use the expression, it got a lot more cleaned up or something along those lines. You know, it immediately brings to mind Giuliani's New York. You know, which went from the trashy Times Square to this sort of safe tourist wonderland. You know, in a sense. You know, I'm not going to be the best spokesperson, you know, for that change. But I was there during Giuliani, so at least I can say that. But as far as where it's gone now, I'm sure a lot of New Yorkers would agree that Manhattan anyway, you know, and a lot of Brooklyn for that matter, you know, is just so overpriced. And part of that is the lack of dodginess.
Yeah. And I think those, the way that New York changed and the way that London changed was contemporaneous. It was, it was a strategy, you know, and you could see it being kind of meted out on the streets, a sense of like, let's just take out what is undesirable. But, right. you know, there are, right. there are, speaking of London, I think there are things about London which are still worth fiercely defending. So we have this, like in the microcosm, something which I suppose predated and preempted Trump, which was the UK's voting to exit Europe, which happened last year. Mm-hmm. And London very much felt like and still feels like its own country.
Mm-hmm.
Because London did not vote to leave Europe. And London has clearly a very different mindset, an international mindset that the rest of the country does not have. So in many ways, I think a lot of us have fallen back in love with London as at least a place of some kind of sense of more progressive values and more international sort of thinking, whereas the rest of the country sometimes looks like a place that I don't understand remotely.
Yeah.
It's a place that seems to want to go back to the 1950s.
Yeah.
And get rid of all of this kind of free movement. So, you know, there's even been talk of whether or not London could broker some kind of an agreement with Europe as a separate entity. I mean, and that's not really viable, but it's really interesting how you feel like you're in a different country in this city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna mention two analogies or analogs to that. One is New York. You know, certainly, in a lot of ways, feels like being in a different country than the rest of the country. But maybe even a better one to what you were talking about as far as the difference from the rest of the country is California, because you know California, you know, there's this fantasy that some of us have about seceding from the rest of the country. Of course, that's also not viable, nor is it going to happen. But it's this sort of self-congratulatory patter that we have about the reason that Clinton got as many votes as she did, and you know that we're the, you know, what is it, like the fifth or sixth, if we were a country, would be like the sixth largest economy in the world, you know, and these kinds of things. So,
right.
But, and yet, you know, alas, we are stuck with the 50s as well.
Well, it's a pretty, I mean, it's the scale of the political landscape, the scale of it in the US is just incredible.
Yeah.
Really, when you think of how that could possibly unify under one ideology, it just seems unworkable. And certainly when I was working at SUNY Buffalo, I was there. I started my position in 2004, and within a few months of starting, it was Bush's re-election.
Mm-hmm.
And the misery and the outcry in that community in Buffalo, and then people saying, why can't we redraw boundary lines, and why can't Canada have us? You know, let's yeah. just ditch it. So, and I was very aware of the kind of East and West Coast kind of worldview compared to, you know, the rest of the country, very different ways of thinking about identity and nationality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we're experiencing here, and we're experiencing all over the world. It's a time where I think national identity and national boundaries are either breaking down or being so strangely asserted.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And how we reconcile this? I mean, and it, I'm sure it's the same in the States, but in the UK, it's across class, it's across age, it's across, you know, it's fathers fighting with their sons. You know, these differences are really divisive. You know,
do you have any differences amongst your nuclear or larger family?
Profound ones.
Okay, you know, give me an example.
My father voted to leave Europe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what have the conversations been like?
He, I think he is even, I mean, I don't think he's gone so far as to refer to me as the liberal elite, but that is certainly his point of view. He finds the progressive nature of a big city like London intimidating, unrecognizable, and he wants everything to slow down, and he wants it to go back to the way he perceives it was.
Right. Where is he? You know, where are you from?
I grew up in, I suppose it would be like the kind of Connecticut equivalent, which is on the outskirts of London in the home counties in a county called Essex, which is more of a rural setting. Although where I grew up was in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
So I literally grew up on the threshold of London. And as soon as I came of age, wanted to leave the suburbs and enter the city.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah.
And I've never really wanted to go back to the suburbs.
Do you agree to disagree, you and your dad, or are you still amicable despite that philosophical difference?
Well, I think it's fascinating, isn't it, family? Because I think that we've more or less agreed that we are to each other the kinds of people that we wouldn't like. We are not the kinds of people that the other person would choose to spend time with. However, we get on very well, and the debate is there, and we have that debate, and it's pretty unavoidable, because I think that what I value is not what he values,
right,
and vice versa.
Do you feel?
You know,
I was just going to say, do you feel, I mean, it's inevitable to think about the situation in the U.S., you know, while you're talking about that. My suspicion is that it's analogizing Brexit to Trump, the recent election, is not, it's not an equal, it's not an equivalent. There, you know, you could certainly say that there are certain similarities, but does it feel any like there's some crossover for you? In other words, I mean, certainly you can talk about how there's difficult conversations among family, but I feel my instinct tells me that the tension in inner family differences in regards to this this U.S. political landscape versus Brexit is more intense. What do you think?
Well, I know that Trump referenced Brexit, much to our surprise, in his campaign, because we didn't really think that was a narrative that was particularly playing out to a US setting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he brought out one of the chief architects of Brexit to speak on his campaign trail.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the comparisons are quite strong. I think the sense of reacting to a global context by closing down your borders and, you know, taking care of your own, this is the rhetoric, is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of, you know, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, after the crash in 2008, how, you know, if you look at countries like Iceland, they managed to prosecute so many of the bankers.
Mm.
But UK and in the US, I don't think anybody saw any, you know, served any time.
Right.
But it's the other, it's the immigrant other, it's the terrorist other that becomes the dominant part of the narrative for, you know, closing down borders and trying. I mean, I think this sense of make America great again is very similar to the narrative of Brexit, which is that we lost our country. This is the perception to diversity, too much integration, a loss of originating values. And I don't subscribe to that view at all. But I think people find it a very compelling narrative. This sense of who are we? You know, and for me, I have quite radical views about national identity. In fact, I don't really identify as a British person.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wouldn't begin to understand what that meant, apart from some kind of anachronisms around, I don't know, you know, food. You know what I mean? Like, I increasingly I wonder why we have these, we attach to countries as as a locus for an identity. Do you see what I mean?
Well, nationalism is a horrible thing, and we could go on that path for a while. But let me go back to your coming to the States. So you were, you came to SUNY Buffalo in 2004, and you were there for 3 years, did you say?
That's right. It was a great program. It was the media study program there. So I had the great privilege of working alongside of Steve Kurtz, part of the Critical Art Ensemble, Tony Conrad, fantastic avant-garde filmmaker and musician who sadly died last year, and had a great time working with grad students. I found Buffalo to be a really great place to make art and make films. It was a good time. In fact, I still collaborate with a few of the people. I made my first feature with a grad student that I met when I was there.
And did you just, did you apply? Did they invite you? How did it come about at the beginning?
So I had a sort of a equivalent position at an art school in the UK, and somebody I know from the program put my name forward and I was invited to come out.
Mm-hmm.
These US kind of university interviews are insane. And in the UK, if you go for a job interview for as an artist at a university, it's like a 45-minute interview and you're out the door.
Right.
In the US, it's like you get given a 48-hour itinerary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's like, including like meeting the dean and getting drunk with the grad students and having to, you know, having to be observed teaching. But I had a blast at the interview and got the gig.
Did they fly you out, or did you have to put up your own expenses?
No, they flew me out.
Oh,
they flew me out. And
so
this
you're
is
being
again,
courted.
It feels like a different time, you know, because this was a university, the SUNY system, where I think 40% of its academic staff were non-US. So, you know, a lot of European thinkers and makers, and it was something that SUNY was very proud of, that international perspective. And SUNY, I think they'd had Derrida had kind of launched his philosophy on the US using the university campus systems, and he'd come to SUNY in the 70s. So this is a really progressive place, you know. But I think that universities now find it much harder to make the case for employing non-US scholars, US practitioners.
So I'm getting from your description of your colleagues, of your time there, and then just dovetailing with what I was going to ask you about anyway, as far as your roots in film and art, that that you could be described as an experimental filmmaker. And like a lot of experimental filmmakers, you, as much as one can, depend on the institution, the university system, for survival to some extent. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, and I think I think it's a privilege to teach, and I think it's really a win-win scenario, because I think it's very stimulating to work with emerging artists and, you know, learn from their perspectives and how they approach their form as they come of age as makers. And I think that bringing new ideas and new concepts that I'm forming to that kind of educational setting is a great way of developing work as well. But yes, I've had a really fortunate time of it, because I got offered to do some teaching straight out of my undergraduate degree. I finished a fine art degree. This is in the mid-90s. And I was always making films. So the whole time I was studying fine art, I was making, we can call them experimental films. The terms kind of move around.
Right.
And they're also cultural. So experimental film has a slightly different meaning here. But I was always experimenting with film, absolutely. And coming straight out of that program, I got offered to teach on that program. And so I was like, I was 23. I was young and inexperienced, but I took the challenge, and so I was able to quite quickly move up through the ranks of teaching and figured out a way of managing my teaching and making art. And it came to a point, I suppose, later on in my 20s, where I might have made the choice to you know, balance making films with more commercial kind of endeavors, you know, doing more, you know, music promos and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
That a lot of people I knew decided to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't take that path. I decided to keep this kind of continuity of teaching and making. And it's, I mean, I'm very fortunate. I have a position in London now where I have a research post. So I get a lot of time to make art.
Wow. So let's go back to that that beginning, because it sounds like that was where it all started and you know, was the foundation for what you're doing now. Was it the case that there was one teacher that particularly was impressed by you, or you know, you had a strong relationship, or was it you know, a combination of a few teachers, or how did that happen in retrospect?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I realized that whilst singing the praises of the academy, I've actually always been kind of anti-institutional, which probably doesn't make much sense. But right. When I was studying art, I spent a lot of time away from the university, because I had a bunch of like punky filmmaker friends in London, and we had our own thing going, and we would crew on each other's films. And so I always had quite an independent, there was no kind of like, if anything, I think more influential teachers would have been at high school that were, you know, I think it's classic for a lot of artists, you know, for me, the art room was the place of safety and the place of freedom. Mm-hmm. When I was at high school.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow that internal relationship you have with yourself and with being able to manipulate things. I had a teacher that when I was about 14 and doing the kind of like you know, taking art classes as a high school student, she gave me a 35mm camera and some film and said, go out and shoot something with this. And I loved that.
Yeah.
Photographing the world and then going into the dark room and feeling that incredible sensation of exposing light to film and then waiting and chemically processing it. And so I think that it was more like art teachers and English teachers at high school that really and really valued, you know, expression, you know.
But the crucial point that I was not that that's not all important, but the crucial point that I was curious about is how you went from being a student at the university, what was the name of the university in London?
The university was outside of London. It was the Exeter School of Art.
Exeter School of Art. Okay. So you're at the Exeter School of Art as a student, and then you become a teacher. So what I was wondering was, had you made such a strong impression with the work that you were making that one or a few faculty said, yeah, this guy might be good as a teacher? Was it that kind of thing? Or, you know what I mean? Or did you brown nose to somebody? Or what was the story?
You know what I did? I made a feature film for my final show.
Mm-hmm.
And with like an ensemble of actors, and it was like this free associative anti-narrative kind of drift film that had this kind of like waveform, like new scenes, new encounters. It was very kind of like free approach to narrative, and it was, I suppose it was a bit of a big deal. It got me a prize and I think it showed, I suppose I was quite independent as a maker, and I had the resourcefulness to be able to get together the cast and the crew. And I think that my professor who invited me to come back and teach saw that I was able to take quite a bit of responsibility, I suppose, at a young age, mm-hmm. and work with others. And that's a kind of big thing for me, is that particularly using film as an art medium is always involved working with others.
Yeah.
And teaching is, I was saying this to somebody, a grad student of mine met me for a coffee yesterday, and he was like, I'd really like to get into teaching. And I was saying, it's, you know, one of the things about teaching is you really are exposed to, and you have to deal with quite profound differences in people, you know, and especially in an art school context, I think people are really, you know, discovering themselves and expressing themselves and breaking out and fucking up and all these kinds of things. And I think that being able to handle that and help people, you know, channel that into something good, I felt I could do,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So something, so, maybe, was it something maybe about being the, being resourceful and being a leader as a director, the way you had to be to make that student film, there's something in that that generally makes, in this context anyway, makes you thoughtful and analytic and sensitive in dealing with these different types of people that you're referring to?
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't thought about it as a kind of, as a philosophy, but yeah, I think that dealing with other people's differences and dealing, and I suppose the other thing that people don't really understand about teaching, and do you teach? Michael, have you done teaching?
I'm sorry. You said, do you teach? Yeah. Very limited, very limited. What you have sounds like a dream to me.
I've been able to, over many years, craft it into a dream, and it's not without its challenges. But the thing I was going to say was that teaching, I think, is performing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Teaching is also improvising.
Sure.
And for me, those are two things that are very central to filmmaking, is that you, to some extent, you're performing that you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because quite often when you're putting a film together, everybody else is invested in what they think you know you're doing. And quite often you've got to act like you know what you're after, and then hopefully it comes.
Right.
I think that teaching is quite similar in that you're only really ever so much ahead of your students, barely sometimes.
Hmm.
But in that performance, there is a dialogue, and in that performance, there is an interaction and an exchange. And I still find that very, like, thrilling, you know, to just talk about art and talk about films. And
oh, yeah, that's the dream part right there.
Yeah. And, you know, it surprises me in the age of, like, you know, Netflix and YouTube and everything, where students tend to think that everything is available, and it isn't. And when you sit down with a group of people and, you know, they're in their, you know, then they're in the early stages of adulthood. And, you know, going back to what we were talking about, the political landscape we find ourselves in at the moment, I think it is a very conservative time that we live in. And it must be brutal to be 20 years old at the moment on so many levels. But actually, when you sit down with a group of people and you share this film that none of them have seen, and everybody's like, I have never seen anything like this, I think that's a really rewarding thing.
Well, I need to tell you that in my thought, in response to your comment of talking about your students having YouTube and Netflix and so on, all these things, and as if everything is available to them. And in fact, as you said, it's not. Well, I thought of your work, because if you go to your website and you've got all those films up on your website, on your film page, those films are not available to you. They're only a select number of excerpts and maybe a couple of short films that are available to you. So what is this about the exclusivity of distribution of your films? And by the way, I'm just going to add one more thing, which is not to overhype an already overhyped artist, but when I saw Matthew Barney's Creamaster films, you know, back in the day when they were coming out, and he was doing a talk with Robert Storr, who was with MoMA at the time. And I said I was going to be in Los Angeles, and, you know, I couldn't see, there was nowhere where I could see your film or get a hold of it. And, you know, he said, oh, it'll be there eventually. You know, it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that is like the ultimate in exclusivity of film distribution. And I just wonder if you and others who make films in an art context take that approach.
Yes, I mean that's an incredibly complex
mm-hmm.
thing, and my point of view of it is it's not straightforward. So, yes, there are artists who work with Moving Image who edition their work, and Barney did the same. You know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want to make a limited edition, you know, Blu-ray, DVD, or whatever. And this makes it collectible. So certain artists working within certain kinds of like commercial settings will do that simply because it creates marketability for their work. And it's not going to be of any use to that marketability if they make that work available on Vimeo or YouTube.
Right, right. Sure.
And then other artists that are working in other distribution networks outside of the gallery, for example, the cinema, or broadcast,
mm-hmm.
similarly, will want to monetize, to somehow find a way to monetize those films.
Right.
They're either monetized by turning them into art objects, or they're monetized by you buy a ticket, or you subscribe to an online platform. And then, of course, there's the festival circuit, and there are many, many, many contexts for the kinds of films that I make, and all of them come with limitations in terms of like public access. So most people, including myself, will either watermark their work or make it available in extract form.
Mm-hmm.
However, older work, I take a more relaxed view on. So a film I made about 16 years ago called Those Who Are Jesus, which is a film about people who think that they're God. And because it's an old film and it had its awards, and you know, it was nominated for a Grierson Award here, and it had its festival life, and it had some broadcast attention, and then it had its day. For a while it was in distribution, and then I just put it up on Vimeo. And I found out, I think I looked the other week, and it had had like 18,000 views on Vimeo, and I hadn't even checked. So I think that films can have first, second, and third lives.
Mm-hmm.
But it's complicated, because if you make all of your work available, I think it somehow can devalue
the right work. Right, sure.
But people take other views, and I think that, you know, I might well be in that respect a product of my generation, and I certainly think that younger makers will crowdfund work and then make it available. But, you know, it's interesting. We're still figuring it out. You know, the ways in which Moving Image artist Moving Image is limited in its edition and monetized or archived, we haven't figured it out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are plenty of, like, works where, you know, materialist filmmakers that refuse to have their films digitized because they want the audience to experience the projection of celluloid.
Right.
And that to a 20-year-old is almost like unthinkable, you know, that you wouldn't want to have it available. But I think that in some ways these ideas are coming back, because we are maybe seeing a kickback from the internet, and people do want to physically experience you know, the performative nature of a film. A film print performs when it's projected and it does things. So, you know, if you want to pay to see a musician play in a band, there's a liveness to that. And I think that film can have that performativity about it.
Right. Well, as far as distribution, the big question that I have and had even from the beginning, as far as being an artist, filmmaker, artist, experimental filmmaker, whatever you want to call it, is if there's any point where you feel like you want to have a larger audience, or certainly at some point, I would imagine one of the questions you're asking yourself is, am I really okay showing my work only to this elite crowd, you know, to this finite audience and not more?
Yeah, well, in the contemporary art world, often the audience is really only other artists or other art collectors.
Yeah.
And it's no different in the film world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've had a strange relationship because in many ways I've felt that what's defined my sort of progression as a filmmaker is feeling like I sit between two communities. So I could easily have gone to film school and been the messy experimental type in a traditional film school setting.
Mm-hmm.
But I chose to go to art school and be the filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And so I've sort of moved between those two camps all of my sort of working life. I sometimes show in the gallery, I sometimes show in the cinema and in festivals. And sometimes the work I make is more, shall we say, obscure,
mm-hmm.
and even academic sometimes. And sometimes the work I make is more broadly accessible.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of a film that you've made that's broadly accessible?
Well, I was just going to add the caveat that in the... For some reason, because there's no strategy, but for some reason, I've tended to always gravitate towards subject matter which is transgressive or taboo or challenging. So even though perhaps the iteration of the work may seem sometimes reasonably orthodox, the subject matter creates its own challenges. Because I think that art should be challenging.
And right.
So where am I going with this? I think that, yes, this thing about mass audience, would it sound really trite to say that these are not things that I really think about? I mean, yeah, you want your work to be seen, but essentially, when you make art, I think you're engaged in working with forms and working with concepts and trying to deal with something.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean? And if I was overly concerned with its audience appeal, I think I'd lose sight of what I was doing.
Right, right. Yeah, no, absolutely. You what you just said is your own version of what an abstract painter I had on the show said. A month or so ago, it's pretty much the same thing. Why I was sort of questioning her about certain kind of abstract paintings sort of just being for other painters, and what about more people kind of was sort of my angle. And she was like, well, why should I care about those other people? I'm working on the things I'm working on, it's kind of the same attitude or approach, I think. But I for some reason, just to use the analogous question I was asking her to you, it's hard for me not to just think about, from my perspective, if you're making films and you have a certain amount of experience with filmmaking, to whatever degree, with quality of production and so on, have you ever thought about making a feature film that would be perhaps, and maybe that the concept of that is just a non-starter because, you know, no, I mean, I don't have screenplays in my head, you know, that I'm fantasizing about. I have these ideas in my head. So if that's the case, if I'm right where I'm going, what's an example of an idea that you have in your head that you are more or less continually trying to work out?
Well, I'm interested in how the act of making a film can give me license as a person, as a human being, to encounter limits. Mm. And to I think that when I'm making a film, I am behaviorally somehow different, and I am able to push or to arrive, intervene, ask, look in a way that the practice, Michael.
You said it in a slightly different context. Go ahead.
The act of making a film, I think, enables me to be strange, and it enables me to encounter my world as a place which is strange.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that has never gone away, not from the first time that I shot film.
Mm-hmm.
It's an act of defamiliarizing and being alien.
Mm.
And it's always the same. It's always the sense of, I see a face, but the face isn't, you know, we can't make accurate representations of our world. I think we can only disfigure or reconfigure and make strange. And for me, moving images are very strange things. And I feel like a stranger to myself when I'm making them. So it's a very liberating process. And so that may sound quite self-involved, because I hope that something is articulated there.
Mm-hmm.
Or something happens that others can the license to be different to it. So no, I don't have any blockbuster screenplays in the back of my head. Although I am interested in story, and I think that story is a form like clay or paint or anything that can be manipulated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that story, sadly, got sold down the river with commercial cinema, and we haven't begun to understand what we can do with how films tell us things and show us things.
Right.
But I've tended in my films to gravitate towards excesses and edges. You know, like I said, people who think they're God, more recently, death and the moment of dying.
Yeah, why don't we talk about that? That's the film you're working on now, right?
Yeah, so I've been working for 3 years on this project, and it started out as a gallery commission, and it will be a 2-month solo show here at this gallery in the UK called Fabrica in October and November of this year, and that will be, I think, an 8-screen installation.
Mm-hmm.
But the gallery put out a call to international artists to respond to the theme of the end of life.
Okay.
And so I wrote an initial proposal which basically said, I would like to be witness to the moment of death. And I think that we don't have images. We have images of birth, but we don't have images of death, and death is as natural and everyday as birth.
Mm-hmm.
But what we tend to have are very euphemistic kind of either very euphemistic images of death or very medical images of death. And I said that I wanted, I suppose, an image of death that comes through art, really. And the thing that I said was that it feels as though aesthetics gets parked when we deal with death, that it's unethical to be aesthetic. We can be aesthetic in painting and to some extent photography, but to be aesthetic in moving image is seen as a kind of a disinterest or a neglect of mm-hmm. the fact that somebody is dying.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't think that should be the case, but I want to find out if that's true.
Mm-hmm.
So they commissioned me And then it took several years to be able to build the partnerships and the trust to be able to be invited to spend time with people as they end their lives. And that is what I did. I spent 12 months filming, and I came to know through the brokering of invitations through medical professionals and nurses. I was introduced to people who were terminally ill.
And that's what I was going to ask you. So you, where do you even start with something like that? So you reached out to medical professionals. Did you just reach out to medical professionals randomly, or did you know any?
Well, I had been a volunteer at my hospice in the East End of London. There's actually a hospice across the street from where I live, and for many years I'd just known it was there, and then one day I walked in and became a volunteer.
And not so, knowing that this would be the seed that you planted for your project, right?
It was one of those strange things where the same month that I started volunteering, I responded to this gallery commission.
Ah, interesting.
Mm-hmm. One was not connected to the other.
Okay.
Remotely.
Right.
And since I've been working on this project, my closest friend, who was the same age as me in his 40s, has died, and very suddenly, and my mother-in-law. And so it's like one of those things where the end of life became very profoundly present to me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, everybody has an association, everybody has a story, and yet I think I can speak generally about this in a Western setting. I think it's not spoken about, or it's not something that we as a community talk about. We maybe talk about it within families.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I reached out to hospitals and hospices.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time, because of course people are very cautious when an artist filmmaker says that they have this objective of filming the moment of death. But one organization just got behind it, and they'd seen my other work, and they got a sense of how I work.
Mm-hmm.
And how I work tends to be I spend a lot of time in the kind of context of where I'm going to make a film before I even get a camera out, a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I get to know all of the complexities of the, you know, I suppose the politics and the discourses of that setting. And so I became pretty well versed in a lot of the politics of end of life at the moment. And there are a lot of politics of end of life.
In addition to doing the research about end of life politics, to what extent were you on hand, you know, in hospice places or otherwise as part of your research?
Well, I was on hand as a volunteer in my own hospice.
Right.
And I came to know quite a few people that way, and I ended up making another film with a young adult with a life-limiting condition. And I, back in the day when I was an art student, I used to make my living, like when I wasn't studying, by working in special needs care.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd always been kind of familiar with working with disability and with illness, and so and had experienced deaths then, and so it wasn't an unfamiliar setting. But yes, I spent a lot of time building up these relationships and building up this trust without getting my camera out and getting a sense of what could be achieved. You know, and at the start, I'd got this like this public art commission money here, and I had money for a whole crew, but I couldn't do it with a crew. So I had to figure out how I was going to do this on my own, because mm-hmm. these situations were so incredibly private,
right,
and intimate.
Let me interject, but I'm wondering, when you're negotiating, getting to that point of negotiation, would you be willing to be filmed? Do you have to determine by that point that this is more of an exhibitionist type of personality or what have you? Or, you know, how, what was the bottom line need that you were going to have in your potential subject?
Well, I think it was a process of mutual selection. And I say mutual. I don't think I did much selecting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was a process of, it was very, I mean, so much of what I do is about ethics and how we think about what is ethically acceptable. And so I had to get that quite clear. So, for example, I never approached anybody because I don't want to put somebody in a situation where they have to say no. I think that's an uncomfortable situation. So there was usually a third party that would say, would you like to meet this artist? He's making a film about mm-hmm. the end of life. Mm-hmm. And that was all done in my absence. And then I would meet with them and not introduce the camera. And I would say, you know, I'd say what I tend to say whenever I make a film, which is I tend to say, I don't know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to say, I'll go where you take me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go where this takes me. And I'm open.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tended to be over the period of months that people that had, I mean, without wishing to get to romanticize it, because end of life it can be really, really painful and difficult and challenging. But I did realize that when people know that they are in the last 12 months of their lives, a lot of things can happen to their identities in terms of, like, a lot of the usual things around ego and around attachment to image or around conservative ideas of what you may or may not want to do. A lot of those things just, I perceived, went out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people would just be like, yeah, sure. Hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And with a couple of people, I was prepared to say to somebody, how would you feel if I was with you when you died? But I never did that. But I had two people say to me, I'd like you to be there.
Wow.
And I became their next of kin. So I had to be on their medical records mm-hmm. just as a sibling or a child would be.
So does this mean that you were one of the few people in their life at that point? How exclusive are we talking about?
In one particular case, because the piece has two outcomes. There's a feature film and there's this gallery show, but both will feature the moment of death of one of the people that I work with, and he had children. His wife had died a year before, and I met his daughter, and we had to have it witnessed that his daughter was fine with me being there and he was fine with me being there, because we knew that he was going to lose consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all witnessed. And then I was the only person in the room when he died.
Huh. How did that work? Something
that he wanted and that his daughter wanted.
Why did they want that?
When you see the work, you'll get a sense of the man.
Uh-huh.
And this is a pretty unique man. Like I said, identity kind of goes out the window to some extent, I think, towards the end of life. But if I were to characterize him, he'd come from a working class background. He'd ran a bus garage. That was his work. But he had something of a philosophy of life. He had seen active service in the war and had somebody shot and died in his arms.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he felt very strongly that he had seen the transformation of body into spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt this as a 20-year-old man, he felt absolutely certain that that there was consciousness and ideation after the death of the body, and he had no attachment to his own body. In fact, he said, I could film whatever. He said I could film him when he was being cleaned after he died, which I did, and dressed. And then his daughter said, well, why don't you film him when his body is at rest in the funeral, I don't know what you call it in the US, in the funeral
home.
Care.
Funeral home. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you ask about how people are selected, and I said it was mutual, this was somebody who I think had taken a radical position about his own body and his own personhood.
Right.
And we had a meeting of minds, you know.
Though I can't help but wonder, did his daughter relinquish the chance to be there at his death because it was too painful, or was it something else?
Because she took the exact same view that he did, which was that it was just his body.
Mm.
And so she said goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
She knew that her father had a profound belief in what was happening to him.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And so she said, in a very practical way, because the whole film takes place on an island off the south coast of England, which is very difficult to reach. You have to take these ferries, and it's not intuitive to get there.
Mm-hmm.
She lived on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, bye, Dad, about a week before he died.
So talk about, describe the moment of death, and what was it, the heart monitor that let you know that the end was finally there?
No, I mean, this is the thing. This is the thing that we have very poor references for the end of life, because we come at them through popular culture like cinema.
Sure.
And we tend to think that it's very mechanistic.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
There are no heart monitors. Most people, they tend to die. Most people will die of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And most people will die of cancer quite late in life, mm-hmm. or heart disease, but mm-hmm. mostly cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the year that I was making this work, every single person I met with had cancer.
Wow.
And every single person had a very pain-managed, largely trauma-free death.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case for him. So it took many days. In fact, because I was his next of kin, the nurses called me at 5 a.m. one time, because it was a 5-hour journey for me to get there every time I was shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you might want to come because Alan was his name. Mm-hmm. We think Alan will die today.
Mm-hmm.
So I drive there. And of course the next day he's up smoking. He smokes lots of cigarettes. He was dying of a non-smoking related cancer, right? He'd smoked about 40 cigarettes a day since he was 16.
Jesus.
And he was dying of a non-smoking related cancer aged 82.
Mm.
And the nurses said that they were absolutely certain that if he wasn't a smoker, he would have died weeks before.
Wow. What's up with that? Hmm.
He was basically staying alive to smoke cigarettes.
I see. It was his will, right.
It was his pattern.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he was locked into a pattern of waking up, and it took about an hour to get him a cigarette, because in order for him to smoke, he'd have to be wheeled out of the building to this outside area.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole team made it happen. And in the film, there many times I have to hold his cigarette to his mouth because he can't physically hold a cigarette anymore.
Wow.
But in the last, when he was actively dying, it took about 2 days. And so I was with him. I filmed without sleeping for 37 hours. I filmed constantly.
And how much of that 37 hours, what percentage of your final film is that 37 hours?
Well, you see, this is what comes back to this thing for me about straddling the gallery and the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are things you can do in an auditorium
right.
that you can't do in a white cube.
Right.
And there are things you can do in a white cube that you can't do in an auditorium.
Right.
So when people go to see a film, they enter into a social, well, they enter into an economic and social contract, which is, I'll give you $15 or whatever it is, however much it costs, and I will sit down in this seat for 90 minutes. And most people do that, even if they don't like the film, they stay. And they get, because they say, I will give you this much time. Nobody does that in the gallery. There's no agreement about how much time you spend in the gallery.
Right.
However, in the gallery, time is available to you, irrespective of what the visitor or the audience is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in the feature version of the film, there is a 7.5 minute sequence,
mm-hmm.
in which Alan dies.
Right.
However, in the gallery piece, I can work much more with that duration.
Right.
And then, of course, what happens is, this is a term I've taken from Haroon Farrokhi, an artist I really admire. He coined this term soft montage,
mm-hmm.
which is the body edits, right? So when you go to a gallery, the person edits by saying, I've looked at this screen for long enough.
Right.
In the cinema, the editor controls that.
Right.
In the gallery, the person controls that.
Right.
So then, of course, you get into all these really interesting dynamics of, when do I look away? When do I walk away? Which is, of course, all the crap we're dealing with culturally about death anyway, which mm-hmm. is, I'm scared to look. I don't know how to behave. I don't know where to stand. I don't know. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. And so, for the purposes of this podcast, we get about anywhere from 35 second to 2 minute version of the death. So speaking of which, I really want to know how you/they determine when the 37 hours started and how you knew that the 37 hours had passed and he had passed.
So, well, again, it was this next of kin thing. They rang me again and I'd already been out and gone home because he was still smoking. And I came back. So again, we come back to this thing about the how fortunate I am to have a research position where I can, to some extent, move my time around. I was having to move around, you know, try and figure this out amongst my teaching. But I went straight back. And, you know, I mean, it's always difficult. Anybody working in a sort of a terminal illness setting will say that the hardest question is, people will say to you, when's my dad going to die? Because, you know, like, I'm in Australia. And, you know, that's not a callous thing. It's a practical thing, is that, mm-hmm. you know, dying takes its own time and it's not predictable. However, there are indicators and signs to do with breathing and to do with the color change in skin pallor and these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came back, it was pretty clear.
And it was, I'm sorry, because you cut off before. You came back how many days later?
5 days later.
5 days. Got it. Thank you.
I came back 5 days later and you know, it was evident that he was actively dying. But even then, the thing that's very interesting is that we think that death is an event, and it isn't really. You can't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, in fact, there is even a cultural difference between the US and the UK about when death is named, because there can be brainstem activity, mm-hmm. and there can even be sort of like random breaths that are drawn
mm-hmm.
after somebody is announced dead. But I filmed for these almost two days, and when he died, it was the middle of the night, about 3 a.m, and one of the nurses came in and said, I think you might see another breath. And we wait for 2 minutes. And then she says, I don't think we're going to hear another breath. And so then they do their examinations of pupil dilation and taking pulse. And then only certain people are qualified to say this person has died. And then you get this tremendous care and attention to the body. Like, his hair was combed, he was washed, he was dressed. And I was very privileged to be there for all of this.
Mm. And in addition to the privilege, what was it like? I mean, obviously, physically, you're exhausting yourself or being exhausted. But what was it like emotionally, I suppose, throughout that ride, if you will?
It's interesting because I felt euphoric. So, and of course, that may sound like an inappropriate response, but I did. I felt as though, I mean, the thing that I've really realized through this project is that death is very, very natural. It's a natural thing. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's also unspeakable. Still, we don't have words. And so something happens in our experience, which is wordless,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt, here was a man who was, there was no way he was going to recover. He was going to die. He wanted to die.
Mm-hmm.
He was happy about dying. And he died. And so, you know, I worked with somebody else in my film who was 40 and had two young children. And I became very close to him. And nobody in his community wanted him to die. And that was very different.
Mm.
But for Alan, I felt really elated that I was invited to be in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I felt like I'd given something to him by being able to be there and record this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would have felt really annoyed with myself if I hadn't been there, but not because I knew that it was really important to him.
Do you think that one of the cliches holds true, that when you do have the opportunity to experience death that way, that it makes you appreciate life more, for lack of a better thought?
I mean, I think I was already in that place because I'd gone through a lot of bereavements myself.
Right.
But I do get asked when I talk about this particular project whether it has changed my feelings about dying. And one of the things that the producer I'm working with on this film, when we've done test screenings of this is the feature version, when we've done test screenings, people say that they felt very nervous coming into the film and they didn't really want to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At the end of the film, they felt that they didn't want to leave the cinema and that they felt somehow that they'd faced down a fear and seen something and felt like, all right, okay, you know.
Right.
Like, it's, I don't want to sound too kind of like, whatever,
New
cliched
age-y.
About it. I think it is, I think in general, if we feel like we can talk about death and acknowledge that death happens, it's ennobling and empowering.
You sure,
know?
Sure.
Because it's real.
You know, what's interesting about what you described in that process, that you had a test screening, you know, to see how people respond to the film. That sounds for such an independent, you know, I mean, we didn't talk about you when I was asking you about, have you ever thought about, you know, making a film, and you were like, you know, no, I don't have blockbuster, you know, screenplays in my head. You know, I was never thinking about that. You know, I think it would be a horrible thing to make a blockbuster film, frankly. I was thinking about really independent films, but what you're talking about, you know, what the market the forum for your films is not only not independent films, it's festivals. You know, it's festivals and it's galleries. So all that to say that when you talked about doing a test for the film, that seems like the kind of thing that would not happen here in the States. You know, you would only have a test for a commercial film. You would not have a test for such a small independent film. Is that, would you agree with that? And is that, how did you arrange to even, was that something you had to take out of your budget to do that?
You know, I don't know if that's the case. But whether or not others would speak about that process,
mm-hmm.
is perhaps more a test screening. It's not like a test screening in the case of a narrative film where the audience decides they wanted a happy ending.
Right.
A test screening is something that, when you're working with a duration like 90 minutes, yes, you're expressing something, you're authoring something, and this is very much an authored film. It's quite a strong proposition.
Mm-hmm.
There's no narration. You don't ever know. Sometimes you don't know people's names. You don't know where you are.
Mm.
There's very little managing the viewer. You're just left. You're there. So it is something that, it's an image that I had in my head that I've put on the screen. And so I wasn't particularly interested in the test screening to do some kind of committee alterations. However, over 90 minutes, there are some things that when you're working on something that closely, you may not know are happening on the screen. You know, you mm-hmm. might not realize that those two faces that people watching think that's the same person. It's things like that that you do test screenings for, just so that you're checking against your own assumptions.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that Matthew Barney, if we're going to use Barney as an example, didn't do test screenings for Cremaster just to figure out pace, just to figure out...
Mm.
It's a part of the process of working with duration on the screen, is that you need to get out of the edit room and think about how it's performing and how it's expressing itself. And well, certainly it was useful to me. I don't always do it, but mm-hmm. it was very important. I see, the other thing about this project is that it's so ethically sensitive that it would be so easy through, maybe even through accident,
mm-hmm.
to put something on the screen that people felt was abusive. And actually, when you're invited into somebody's very private experience, you need to feel like you're allowed to watch.
Right.
And one of the things we wanted to test is, did you feel like you were allowed to watch this?
Mm.
And actually, that comes back to aesthetics, and it can come back to how the camera is handled, how the edit is handled. The point of view of the film can be an invasion rather than an invitation. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you mentioned a while back, you said, when we were talking about this film, and I can't remember exactly what I was asking, but I was asking something about it, and you said, well, when you see it, you'll see that. So now I have to ask, well, when will I see it, Stephen? when is it going to be on Netflix?
Yeah, yes. Well, at the moment, we are completing the sound design for the mm-hmm. film. We essentially are looking for the way these things work is you look for an international premiere and mm-hmm. then a national premiere and mm-hmm. then a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those things are in play at the moment. And so I will almost certainly be bringing it to a US festival setting. And then with distribution permitting, there'll be distribution networks, either theatrical or online, for the feature version.
Right.
Then for the multi-screen, that piece is transferring to a gallery in Toronto in January.
Mm-hmm.
Then essentially it will be available to be taken up as a gallery piece internationally. Right. But it will be a very different proposition as a gallery
sure,
piece.
Sure, of course. And what festivals are you submitting to?
So we're talking to, I mean, essentially the way it works with festivals, it's a bit of it's a relationship the festivals have with press and the press have with distributors. So the more A-list or prestigious a festival you can get, the better press you can get. And this is across the board. This is for like artist film, documentary. I mean, it's not the case for big budget commercial cinema, but for most independent film or artist film,
mm-hmm.
you still need some press, which gets a distributor interested. So you need a certain kind of level of world stage. So the first feature that I made, we premiered in Tribeca, which is a great festival
sure.
in downtown Manhattan.
Right.
And so that enabled us to get, we traveled the world with that film, with Tribeca as an A-list festival, as our launch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was, again, an obscure art film that was mixing documentary and fiction. So it wasn't an easy sell.
Yeah. So with this film, and what is the film's title? Do you have one yet?
For the one I'm finishing now?
Yeah.
Island.
Island, thank you, yes. So is Island being submitted to Cannes, for example?
No, we didn't think Cam was right.
Doesn't make sense, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's finding, you know, it's very similar to the artist-curator or gallerist relationship, and you'll know this, that you need to have some dialogue, and actually it's not about just taking the festival that wants your film. You need to know that festival is going to take care of that film and
right.
And present it in the right way, because you can only really, you know, premiere this work once.
Right.
So
right.
It's working with festivals that are sympathetic to artists using film
mm-hmm.
and want to champion that. It's working with festivals that can be brave around a
right.
film, which,
right.
which we think is actually quite an accessible piece, although it's quite, as I said, it's quite a strong proposition. There's a sense of, you know, how are we going to do that death film? And it's not that film.
I yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah, or they may take it on, but if it gets wrongly framed or put in the wrong setting, you know, for us, because we have this the gallery piece as well,
yeah,
and I've also written a lot around the work because from part of my research process is to write and to publish. And so I think there's a debate. The film can be a part of a debate around, you know, how art always had a relationship with death. You know, the history of art is in many ways the history of looking at death and death and the afterlife, especially in painting. And then in photography, but actually it fell out of the kind of popular discourse, I think, in contemporary art and in terms of like mass media. And we're trying to say that this could be a focus for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we want a festival and a distributor that's going to understand that and handle it carefully and take pride in that. So there's a sense of like at the moment it's just having those conversations and getting it to the right stage.
Right. So you will let us know who the festival is when that's determined, then, not before.
I will. And I think we will know in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. Okay, very good. All right. Well, I thought it might be, especially on the heels of talking about death, hopefully this will be a decent segue. I thought we would be remiss if we didn't talk about how you and Kaisa, who is our mutual connection, met. And without the listeners knowing anything about this, do you want to just like concoct maybe a 10 to 12 minute version of that story? How does that sound?
Oh, I don't think I need to take 10 or 12 minutes.
Okay, but 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was thinking about this before we came on to speak about how, I suppose, trauma or situations which throw you far out of your comfort zone can accelerate things.
Right.
And I suppose that's something that I've always been interested in as an artist, is how we can go through situations where suddenly change is very accelerated. And it's usually, I think, around things that shatter your coordinates, where you're like, I have no idea. Nothing is the same. Nothing is real. And that was certainly how my friendship with Kaisa Johnson began, because we were both, well, I think she was finishing her studies at Glasgow School of Art, and I was not long graduated from my fine art program, and we were both of us independently were holidaying on this island, the Arran island of Arran off the west coast of Scotland.
And now why did you go there? Is it known for something that's particularly attractive?
I have no idea. I was holidaying with a friend of mine, and she was holidaying with a friend of hers. It's a very remote island that has the same bus timetable since before the Second World War. It's got a whiskey distillery. It's got a lot of standing stones and natural waterfalls.
That sounds nice.
I think it's great. It's just, I forget. I think we were going paragliding. That's why.
Ah.
My friend and I were doing paragliding because you could climb up this mountain and throw yourself off it. And I think for Kaisa, it was an intuitive holiday, like vacation destination from Glasgow, because her friend was over visiting her.
Right.
So it was within easy reach. So we both found ourselves at this guest house. And the people that ran the guest house had said that it was a full moon and it was going to be a clear sky. And if there was a certain point on the island where you could watch the moon set and rise, because it would drop down and come up behind the island of Mull, the adjacent island. So they drove us in this Land Rover and deposited us under this beautiful starry sky in midsummer to watch this moon. And it was the four of us. And they said, it's about a 4 mile walk back along the lane. Enjoy your night. We had some beers with us, and you know, they said, be careful when you walk, because there may be, this is an exact quote, there may be some tufty bits. So we sat there literally sitting on these standing stones, these ancient standing stones, thousands of years they've been there. And we watched the moon set and rise. And Kaisa and I really hit it off, and we're talking about, you know, art and our work. And then the clouds came over, and it became pitch black. So we followed our noses, being kind of urban types, and our noses were useless. So we started to encounter this bog. So we were up to our ankles, and then we thought we'd better turn back because the bog wasn't particularly nice. So we turned back, but we had no vision. And so we redirected, we were up to our knees, and then we were up to our waists wading, but we couldn't see anything. We could only hear each other's voices.
Wow.
And then we became very disoriented, and then we were wading up to our chests. And then I think Kaisa's friend started crying and became very scared. And my friend and I felt responsible as the kind of natives of the islands,
right,
that we should at least have some geographic sense, but we didn't. And so we just kept waiting and waiting. And you know, it gets bad because everybody goes quiet. There's no banter. There's no spirited conversation. It's just, you become like you regress to like this animal type. So we all just silently waited. And I think all felt quite, I mean, it's a, what do they call it? A first world problem. But we felt at the time as kind of, you know, young adults, I think we felt pretty scared. Finally, we found our way out. I think we started taking like flash photography to try and see our way because I had my camera with me.
Oh, okay.
But we spent the whole night trying to get out. So, and then the sun came up and it was dawn. Kaiser found a phone box, I remember, and rang her mum in Connecticut and said, "I love you, mum." And then we were covered from head to foot in mud. And Kaiser's been my very dear friend ever since. You know, it was like a baptism,
right?
Literally, a baptism in Scottish bog.
No, I didn't stop you at any point in the story. But one question I had is, when you're in the water, I mean, this is Scotland, so presumably it's pretty cold, right? I mean, was hypothermia at all on the table? Potentially,
I think at the time, and we're going back 20 years almost, I think that none of those rational thoughts were going, but there's just this sense of like dread or I don't know how to solve this. And I think that, you know, to bring it back to more broadly what we've been talking about, I think that often like transformative things happen when we're lost. And it's increasingly hard to get lost.
Right.
And that's something that I think we're really missing culturally.
Yeah.
Is, okay, I wouldn't have cultivated that situation. I wouldn't have sought it. But something in it produced a friendship and produced a memory. And I had no GPS. I had no, you know, there was no guiding principle. And I think that that's something that, to be lost for me, is if you can find a place where you are outside of your known coordinates. And for me, that's something that I'm still trying to find in art, is that place of like, I don't know the terrain. I don't know the coordinates. And for me, often that's where friendships and relationships and dynamics emerge. And we certainly, it was totally unspoken. It wasn't as though Kaisa and I said, right now we're friends for life. It was absolutely, it was like a rite of passage, you know? Yeah. And I think quite often those uncommon relationships start that way, you know, in something just out of the ordinary.
And were you in touch with your mortality in that event?
I think we all were all afraid, and we all went quiet. You know, if somebody had rationally said, well, "Come on, you're not going to die here, really, are you?" But I think that I think that we felt vulnerable, and
right,
and that's where the transformation happened. But, you know, I don't want to overstate it because, like I said, it was a bog in a Scottish island. It wasn't a minefield or a...
right. <no. laughs> Yeah.
But, you know, I think that going off grid is what you do when you're a young adult. And then we tend to stop doing it. And I think that for me, that's part of the nature of making art, is to, you know, in the manipulation of things, you go off grid and you're like, I don't understand what's happening here, but I'm going to go with it, you know?
Right.
And I think that's something that Kaiser and I share, is that sense of like, you follow that thing. You don't just name it ahead of time. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Well, Stephen, I feel like, we've covered a lot. I'm sure we could cover more, but for now, you feel like we're good?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I wanted to ask you more questions. I kept trying to
Yeah, you gotta try harder, Steve. We'll,
I know. Sorry, I did try.
I'm teasing. We'll have a follow. If we have enough interest in this, we'll have a follow up, and you can ask me questions.
Yeah, or maybe I need to set up a podcast this side of the Atlantic and then invite you in.
Yeah, yeah. Please do. Please do.
I would enjoy that. I have greatly enjoyed the conversation, Michael.
Great. Me too, Steve. Thanks so much. And we're out.
Thanks so much again to Stephen Eastwood. I hope you guys got a lot out of that. I think there was a lot to get, a lot to contemplate, a lot to chew on. Yeah, so I want to give some thank yous, some shout outs. I want to get into that anecdote that I gave you a preview about at the beginning about the incident at the studio. So please stick around for another few minutes. First, I want to give a shout out to former guest Hillary Petches has a show that just opened on the 21st of April at Joshua Liner Gallery in New York. That's on West 28th Street. So if you're in New York, go check out that show of Hillary Petches. And wanted to give a couple of big thank yous to John Product of JMM Consulting. He is in New York, and he gave a very generous donation via PayPal. Thank you, John. Also recently, Jennifer of Seattle, she didn't really need a shout out, but I wanted to give her one. Thank you, Jennifer, very much as well. And this show is made for free. Kate Mitchell, who I can't thank enough for the help that she provides doing, helping with the booking for the show, is instrumental in keeping the show going. And I obviously I do it for free as well. So your donations really do keep the show going. I encourage you to donate to the show if you haven't already, either one time via PayPal, as John and Jennifer did, or I definitely would appreciate donations ongoing via Patreon, Patreon. That's linked through the website as well. And you can donate for as little as a dollar a month. So that's $12 a year, or $3 a month will get you access to the bonus, now three bonus clips or episodes. That's $36 a year. So that's not too bad, I think. And if you could jump on board Patreon and become one of the few current Patreon supporters, it would bring us closer to meeting our goal as far as ongoing support of the show. And if you donate $3 via Patreon or $25 one time via PayPal or more, you will have access to the bonus episodes, including the most recent one with Eric Yonker, who is a very witty and charismatic speaker, for those of you, few of you who have listened so far. And if you are already a supporter of the show and you haven't got that, just let me know and I will send it to you. And by the way, one other sort of little thing to maybe entice you to make me happy, or the experience of making the host happy, is when I go into Gmail, as I do, the Gmail for this show, there is a folder on the far right simply called updates. And when I get a PayPal donation, I see a little orange new logo or symbol, and it says next to it PayPal. So it, unless it's like there's some problem, which has happened occasionally, it means that it's a new donation, and it's very sweet. It's very exciting to see that little pop-up in the updates folder. So just an FYI, okay? Thank you so much to those of you who are already supporters. And if there's anything I can do to make your support of the show more satisfying, as far as what I can do for you, what I can give you, shout outs or what have you, always feel free to let me know. You can also support the show without donating any money by following the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and you can become a fan on Facebook. And you can tell others about the show. You can also leave a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the website, and that helps other people find the show. The landscape for art podcasts is getting more crowded every day, so your support and your word of mouth really does help. So let's get to Incident at the Studio, for those of you who are still around. This was Easter Sunday afternoon or early evening, and I'm working at the studio. Let me just give you a quick setup of what this studio is like. It's a one-story building. It's got a couple of patios around the side, so it's nicely landscaped. It's got some brick patios, and it's kind of a rabbit warren of spaces. One side of my space is a couple of pair of barn doors that I very rarely use. So I enter through the opposite side of the building, which is a door from the outside, a long hallway, and then an interior door that goes to the space that I share with two other people. So I'm sitting there working, and as I turn, I see this guy leaning against the doorway to my studio. I had left the outside door and the inside door ajar, as I often do, because it usually feels safe around there. And this guy is just there. There had been no announcement. There had been no noise. He's just there. And he says, "I'm too freaked to say anything. I might have said, hey," something like that, rather than, "What the fuck are you doing here?" But he says, "Do you know Claudio Velasquez?" And I say, I think, well, there is this guy who's been doing casting in a space on the other side of our studios that I hear but have never met. And I think, oh, well, maybe he's looking for this guy. I haven't met this guy, but maybe that's who it is. And I say, well, I think I know who you're talking about. Let me point you in direction. So he goes off ahead of me slowly, and we head towards the door to our studio, which goes to the hallway. He's in the hallway, and he says, "Here?" And he points to the bathroom. He says, "Here in the bathroom?" I said, no, keep going. He points to the door to the studio at the end of the hallway. He says, "Here?" No, it's not. Keep going. You have to go out the front door. And then, so he goes out the front door, and he says, "Can you show me?" And my thought is, he's got some friend out there, and they're going to mug me. Right? That's the thought that essentially that came to mind. So I can't remember if I said anything, maybe just keep going. And I went to the door, I shut it and locked it. And fortunately I didn't hear any knocking or anything like that. So I turned around, went back into my studio, and I debated whether I should call the cops. And about 10 minutes later, I called 911 and explained the situation. So That was the main part of the anecdote. The sort of follow-up was that I found out from acquaintance on the other side of the building, who's there all the time, who does ceramics, that he had been harassing, sort of loitering around her space, and she said he was a drug addict, and she explained the situation where she repeated the name of this woman, Claudio Velasquez, and he put his hat down and his face completely changed. So there's some mental illness going on there as well, apparently. The Culver City police ended up coming the next day, and I gave these two guys a report. The first guy I gave it to, and then his partner, who I guess needed to actually take the report, came later by a half hour or so. And as I was telling the story again to the second of the pair of officers, the first one was, when I told them about how the guy was just standing there, he kind of laughed because it was like, it was even incredulous to him, a police officer. So I think we feel a little more safe. I haven't talked to this woman or on the other side who does the ceramics about how, if she's feeling better now that they've taken a report, but it was a creepy situation. So that is my incident at the studio story. I hope you enjoyed that. I guess we're now closer to 10 minutes than maybe 6. But I appreciate you guys sticking around. And if you can spread the word, great. If you can support the show if you haven't already, much appreciated in advance. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.